It was a case that would impact every voter in the United States, one that could affect the outcome of the upcoming congressional and presidential elections. Retired federal judge Michael Luttig described it as the most important case for American democracy in almost 2.5 centuries.
So the stakes in this case were immense.
Moore versus Harper began in North Carolina. The state Supreme Court was asked to rule on whether the U.S. Constitution gave state legislatures exclusive power over redistricting and election rules. It was a decision that could change the vote by creating a political advantage.
So in this case, the Republicans were in charge of the House of Representatives in North Carolina, and they drew a map that heavily favored Republicans.
The redrawing of North Carolina's map was challenged all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, a court with a majority of conservative justices. Coming off the back of the court's decision to overturn Roe versus Wade, many worried it was a steep uphill battle, even for the most seasoned lawyers.
It was a little terrifying, I will tell you.
Neil Katyal, a partner at Hogan Lovells with extensive experience arguing before the Supreme Court, took up the challenge and put together a team. But the pressure was palpable.
I knew we didn't have any margin for error. I had to give basically a perfect oral argument, and we had to write a perfect brief.
If they lost, state lawmakers in all 50 states would have nearly unchecked power over federal elections. With the 2024 elections coming up, the stakes couldn't be higher. I'm Kate Stetson. This is Proof in Trial, Season 3, Moore versus Harper. Moore versus Harper was a crucial case for American democracy. It would have ultimately erased 200 years of legal precedent, allowing state lawmakers the unfettered ability to change election rules to benefit their political party. Because of its significance, it was closely watched by American voters and was covered by almost every major U.S. newspaper and broadcast channel. At the heart of the issue was whether the U.S. Constitution gives state legislatures almost unchecked power over running federal elections. If this was found to be true, the political party in charge of the state's House of Representatives had the ability to change how districts were carved out in the state's voting maps, otherwise known as gerrymandering, and other crucial voting rules to favor their candidate. In North Carolina, that is exactly what happened. Hogan Lovells' Neil Katyal explains.
North Carolina had a very conservative group of state legislators, and they drew the maps so that 11 of the 14 seats would be given to Republicans, only 3 to Democrats. And that's an unusual thing because North Carolina is a politically evenly divided state. It's roughly 50-50. So you'd expect the maps to be drawn 7 for Republicans, 7 for Democrats. But that's not what happened with these so-called gerrymandered districts. They were done to benefit a particular political party.
Neil is Hogan Lovell's lead lawyer on the case. He's a well-known litigator in the U.S. Supreme Court, having argued more Supreme Court cases in U.S. history than any other minority attorney. But before we head to the U.S. Supreme Court, let's take a step back to explain how the case reached the highest court in the United States. And I have to first start with a short history lesson, so bear with me. The House of Representatives is one of the 2 chambers of Congress, the other being the U.S. Senate. It's part of the federal government's legislative branch. The number of voting representatives in the House is fixed by law at no more than 435, and they represent the population of the 50 states. Every 10 years, the U.S. Constitution requires that a census take place. Based on the results of the census, the number of seats allocated to each state is adjusted proportionally, and state maps are redrawn to reflect the redistribution of the population to ensure U.S. citizens are fairly represented in Congress. In the case of North Carolina, its population was growing.
North Carolina is a great place to live. Lots of people are moving there, great schools, a nice climate. And so they picked up a seat in the House of Representatives. And this is a big deal. It's more voting power for North Carolina. But the question is, who gets to elect that new person to the House of Representatives. And when this happens, it's a big deal in the state because it's an opportunity to redraw all the voting lines. And this really matters because how the lines are drawn, ultimately, for better or for worse, affects who gets elected.
That was Katie Wellington, a Hogan Lovells appellate lawyer who worked on the case with Neil. As Neil said, the new lines were drawn to favor the Republican Party. The move didn't go unnoticed.
After the North Carolina legislature drew the maps, they were challenged by a variety of groups: voters, Common Cause, which is the entity I represented, a nonpartisan group dedicated to protecting voting rights, and others. And the North Carolina Supreme Court agreed with the challengers and said these maps violate principles of democracy enshrined in the North Carolina Constitution going back to the year 1776, before even the United States Constitution was adopted.
But it wasn't over. The state legislators didn't agree with the court's decision and appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. That's when Neil became actively involved. Common Cause and Becky Harper, the woman who agreed to be a plaintiff in the case, reached out to him and asked if he'd lead a team to defend the judgment before the Supreme Court of the United States. For Neil, the decision was an easy one.
It was a real privilege to represent Common Cause. I'd actually seen in high school the head of Common Cause give a speech, and I loved the idea that you could stand up for a principle, and not in a partisan way, but in a way that's a truly American way. And it had always resonated with me. And so when they asked me to get involved, I really jumped at the opportunity.
He got to work building an impressive team to help him.
Our team was diverse in every way, including politically diverse, something I feel is really important to become a great Supreme Court advocate. It had Katie Wellington on it, a woman who clerked for Chief Justice John Roberts of the Supreme Court, as well as Justice Brett Kavanaugh, one of the newer justices to the court. It had Will Haveman on it, who clerked for Justice Breyer of the United States Supreme Court. It had Michael West on it. Michael, a brilliant, brilliant historical researcher, he was the person, more than anyone, who spent, you know, day after day in the archives unearthing a lot of the historical material that we used.
Katie was happy to join.
Neil came to me and said, "Katie, you know, this is the case of the year. This is the blockbuster case. This is one of the most important cases you may ever work on. Do you want to do it?" And I was like, "Yeah, sure, of course. You know, this is what you live for as a constitutional lawyer, to think deep thoughts about the Constitution and American democracy and to fight for those principles in the Supreme Court."
Judge J. Michael Luttig, a retired federal judge on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit, was also a member of the Common Cause legal team and Neil's co-counsel. A well-respected conservative judge, he believed it was the most significant case in the history of American democracy and quickly became a key player.
It was incredible working with Judge Luttig on this case. We ran drafts by him. We took his views into account. He's been thinking about these issues in a really deep way for a long time and had some incredibly valuable insight as we were putting the brief together, and also at oral argument, thinking about how to answer tough questions, what's the right approach with respect to specific justices. He had some great insights on all of that and was an integral member of our team.
Having a former conservative judge working alongside a nonpartisan group to fight against a Republican election law challenge may sound surprising, but everyone agreed the argument wasn't a political one. It was about the Founding Fathers and the true meaning of the United States Constitution.
And when I looked at the case, I felt there was a path to victory, that many people were thinking about this case in political terms, like Republicans versus Democrats. And instead, my view was we needed to take and reframe the case, not as the Republican National Committee versus the voters of North Carolina, but the Republican National Committee versus the checks and balances and system of government that James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, and others celebrated. So the key move we made in the briefing was to devote an enormous amount of attention to the original history of the United States Constitution.
The Republican National Committee's argument was based on what's called the independent state legislature theory, a theory that emerged after the 2000 presidential elections.
So in the early 2000s, you have Bush v. Gore. There's this huge debate over who's going to be the president. There's the Florida recount. It's this pivotal moment in U.S. constitutional history. And there's this new interpretation of the Constitution that comes out of that. And it grows into what is now called the independent state legislature theory. And the idea is to look at the text of the Constitution, which says that the times, places, and manner of holding elections for senators and representatives, that's what's at stake here in North Carolina, shall be prescribed in each state by the legislature thereof. So it's a textualist argument that says the federal Constitution says it's up to the state legislature to make the rules about elections. And there's nothing that the state courts or the people of the state or even the federal courts can do about it. It's just up to the state legislatures.
Neil and his team disagreed.
The Republicans' argument was to the Supreme Court was the text of the Constitution says legislature thereof. Doesn't say courts, doesn't say anyone else, just says legislatures. Our argument was in order to understand what legislature thereof meant, you had to understand what those words meant in 1787. That's a conservative method of constitutional interpretation called originalism. But we felt that it had enormous, enormous sway with this case and with this court. And so we developed a deep historical argument showing in all sorts of different ways that the Constitution, when it used those words, meant legislature thereof pursuant to ordinary checks and balances, including what we call in America judicial review, the possibility of judges to review actions by legislatures for compliance with the Constitution. So that was the key move we made in the briefing, and it became ultimately the key move in the oral argument.
With so much at stake, not only for North Carolina, but also for the country, the preparation involved was immense. The team spent months combing through constitutional law to build a case that would resonate with the Supreme Court justices.
Our team is a key part of our success in the Supreme Court. There's so many new people on the court, and thinking through how to get through to those new justices. What arguments are most likely to appeal to them? Thinking through their jurisprudence when they were on the Court of Appeals, what law review articles have they written? What questions have they asked in other cases? And we think about all of that. We looked at past, opinions they'd written, because this was such an important case and we didn't want to leave any stone unturned in thinking about how to win the votes that we need at the Supreme Court. You always want to win 9 votes, but you'll take 5. So figuring out how to get to 5, that was our job in this case.
For Neil, his months of preparation included weeks of practice sessions. He relied heavily on other members of his team and his AirPods.
What I do to get ready is I do practice session after practice session with them. Sometimes I do as many as 15 of these practice sessions in which they're throwing questions at me. And then I take the audio recording and I make it into an MP3 file, and then I will run or ski or commute sometimes to it, and I'll be listening to my answers and thinking, how can I make them better before the next practice session? And that steals me when I go into the Supreme Court.
His sheer determination and drive didn't go unnoticed by those around him.
And one of the things I find so impressive about Neil is how much work he puts in. We must have mooted this case every day for about 2 weeks. And he goes to everybody he knows and says, will you hear me argue? Will you ask me the toughest questions? Will you give me all of your feedback? No matter how harsh, I want to hear it. And it's just really impressive to see the process that he goes through, how much input he gets from so many people and sources before he gets in front of the court, and really how well prepared he is when he gets up there to argue.
Despite the team's extensive experience, arguing in front of the Supreme Court is always a nerve-wracking experience.
Arguing in the U.S. Supreme Court is always, frankly, terrifying. It was terrifying for my first argument, which was a big argument about Guantanamo. It was terrifying for my 50th argument. And the reason is that it's high pressured. You only have a half hour. And there's no really any room for you to slip up. It's kind of like the Olympics. If you slip up, you're not going to get hired again. And so there's a lot of pressure.
The Supreme Court is an impressive building, built in 1935. The main entrance is supported by 16 marble columns and faces the United States Capitol.
You think of the Supreme Court as this incredible, imposing institution that's making all these important decisions that impact our lives, and all of that is true. But the courtroom itself is pretty small. And when you're up there in front of the justices, you are really close to the justices, just, you know, maybe 10 feet away. You can see all their facial expressions. You can see their reactions. You can see when they whisper to the person next to them on the bench.
And what that means is, if you're nervous, if you're sweating, they see you sweat. It is intimidating in a way. But ultimately, what I've had to do is make the shift in my mind to thinking it's a conversation, that we're here and engaged in a search for truth. And if we can have not speeches at one another or kind of hot rhetoric, but instead see that we're in a common calling to try and find the truth, that mental shift becomes enormously important to me, and I hope that it benefits the court.
Each lawyer had just half an hour for their oral argument, answering rapid-fire questions from all 9 justices.
I had chills listening to the oral advocates. They were among the best oral advocates in the country, and they were all in this case. So you have Neal standing up there, former acting Solicitor General. You have Don Verrilli, former Solicitor General. You have Elizabeth Prelogger, General Prelogger, current Solicitor General. These are the best oral advocates in the country. And the feeling in the courtroom was that our side of the equation was so much stronger. We had the constitutional history. We had these powerful statements by our founding fathers on our side. We had these incredible oral advocates.
When it was Neal's turn to approach the podium, he knew what he needed to do.
After COVID, the court moved to a process first with speakerphones, where we had to argue the case on speakerphones from our houses. And in the speakerphone era, the idea of justices talking over each other or an advocate was unseemly. And so what they said is each justice is going to take turns in order of seniority, asking questions. Justice Thomas is the most senior justice in the majority, and so he would start the questioning. Once we moved back to the courtroom, basically the court relaxed those rules and any justice could ask a question at any time. But a curious thing happened. All the justices were deferring to Justice Thomas, who's the most senior, to ask the first question. And so I knew that I was going to get my first set of questions from Justice Thomas. And Justice Thomas is the key person at the Supreme Court behind this idea of originalism, original understanding of the Constitution. So I developed a set play, which I employed right at the oral argument. So I give my opening. Justice Thomas asks the first question. I can't remember what it is, honestly, right now. And then I said something to the effect of, Justice Thomas, may I say, in the more than 2 decades I've been arguing cases before you, I've waited for this case because this case speaks to your method of constitutional interpretation, original understanding of the document. And here are the 4 things you need to know about the founders and the original understanding of the document. And I went through Madison and Hamilton's views. I went through the Articles of Confederation, which governed America from 1781 to 1787, and the like. And I would say it was a major turning point in the oral argument. It allowed us to lead with where we wanted to be, the history, and to speak to conservatives and their method of interpretation.
Neal's delivery was powerful and direct. Judge Luttig called it, quote, the single best oral argument I have ever heard made before the Supreme Court of the United States.
You felt like you were witnessing a moment in history, and to get to see it in person was just incredibly cool.
However, back in North Carolina, things had changed. The state Supreme Court did a U-turn and overturned its original ruling.
North Carolina has elections for their state Supreme Court, like many other states, and the Supreme Court switched political parties and switched its decision and said, actually, We've looked at the North Carolina Constitution, and it doesn't say anything about partisan gerrymandering. The legislature can do what it wants. And that was a pretty strong decision. It felt like a defeat for the folks on the ground in North Carolina. And I think it really scared some people on our side of the equation.
While the Hogan-Lovells team remained confident they had succeeded in winning the case, the news rattled many. The feeling among some parties was that the Supreme Court would not be on their side, and they'd rather not get a decision than lose.
After the oral argument, something really striking happened. I've never seen it in all of the dozens of cases I've had at the Supreme Court. Basically, everyone on our side of the case, except for us, Common Cause, but everyone else thought we had lost and told the Supreme Court to get rid of the case, to declare it moot, to say the case couldn't be ruled upon. They all filed briefs in the United States Supreme Court saying that, including the Biden administration's Solicitor General, the top lawyer for the Biden administration.
The Hogan-Lovells team and Common Cause had to make a decision. Do they agree with the others and ask the Supreme Court to declare the case moot, or do they press on and ask the court to rule on the case? It turned out to be an easy decision.
I and my team looked at this. We felt that we had won the case based on the oral argument, and we concluded, unlike everyone else, we had won. We then had to construct an argument for why the case wasn't moot. And that's a whole technical thing, which I won't bore our listeners with. But we filed a piece of paper to the Supreme Court, a brief, that said, the case was not moot, please decide the case. I knew when I signed my name to that paper, if I made the wrong call and I convinced the Supreme Court to keep the case, and then they ruled against us, ruled for the Republican National Committee, ruled for the idea that state legislatures have carte blanche to do what they want, it would be, as Judge Luttig said, the end of American democracy. I also knew it would be the end of my Supreme Court career because I don't think anyone would want to hire the guy who made such a bad call again. And so the stakes were enormous.
With the support of Common Cause, the Hogan-Lovells team kept the case alive. And while they remained confident the decision would be in their favor, that didn't stop them from worrying about what they'd just done and the consequences.
I will not mince words. I was very worried about being out on my own and having no support from anyone, except, I should say, Judge Michael Luttig. Again, this is one of the most conservative jurists in our, you know, in my lifetime. But someone who deeply believed that we were right in this case and that we had won the oral argument. And he gave me a lot of strength personally in many phone calls to say, I've got your back, you're doing the right thing. And to have someone of his stature quietly at my side meant more to me than I can say in words.
Now all they could do was wait. Had they won over the justices of the U.S. Supreme Court?
It was terrifying. For weeks, there are certain days when the Supreme Court releases opinions, and we were all on the website checking, you know, which opinions are coming out. Is this our case? And as time dragged on, we got more and more convinced that the Supreme Court was going to get to the merits. If they were just going to dismiss this case as moot, they would have done it in kind of short, perfunctory way. And we were getting more and more positive, but it was nerve-wracking. It's nerve-wracking to take a position like that and to potentially lose your credibility, you know, but we felt it was the right thing to do.
And it was. The Supreme Court ruled 6-3 in their favor. They had won the case in a big way.
We were sitting on our computer, you know, waiting. And then we got the decision and we had to read it. You know, you can't just assume that the first paragraph is it. So we took about 10 minutes to get through as quickly as we could. And then we're like, okay, we won. We won all across the board. We won everything. I mean, that's something that often doesn't happen in the Supreme Court either. You don't win everything. We won everything. And we were just partying, you know, that was it for the day. No more work was getting done. We were celebrating, you know, talking to each other, talking to our client, talking to our colleagues. It was a really big victory and a really amazing moment in my career.
Following the decision, Common Cause held a press conference to celebrate the victory. Becky Harper, the Common Cause member who agreed to be a plaintiff in the case, was thrilled with the outcome.
This is an exciting day for voters in North Carolina, and in fact, voters across the country, that we do indeed have a system of checks and balances. Voters just want honest elections. Voters want the ability to pick their representatives. And when legislatures gerrymander districts, what's happening is the legislature is picking their voters rather than the voters picking their representatives. That's how elections get fixed and get tarnished from the beginning, before ballots are even cast.
Katie also celebrated the fact that the ruling proved politics doesn't have to interfere with Supreme Court decisions.
This case is a really strong rebuttal to people who say that the Supreme Court only rules on political grounds. This case at the Supreme Court level wasn't about politics. It was about the Constitution, the constitutional text, the constitutional history, going back to the framers of the Constitution. What kind of system did they set up? That's how we litigated this case, and that's how we won this case. And if you think the Supreme Court is solely political, if you're just counting votes, this case may have come out the other way. And I think it's a great example of how the Supreme Court really cares about the Constitution, about these fundamental principles, and why we have a Supreme Court in the United States.
For Neil, a lawyer who has spent his career dedicated to ensuring American citizens have the right to a robust democracy, the decision meant there would be less ambiguity in the upcoming elections.
I am so proud that my law firm, Hogan Lovells, invested so much in this case and in me, because deciding Moore versus Harper has clarified the rules for the 2024 election in a massively important way. Up until Moore versus Harper, there was a deep cloud hanging over the question of whether state courts had any role to play in federal elections, either at the congressional or presidential level. Will there be other issues in the 2024 election? Almost certainly. But at least this has given an answer to one of the most fundamental questions, which is, do state legislatures call all the shots? From polling hours to how you draw the maps, all sorts of things like that. Or do state courts have a role? And secondarily, an important question, can state legislatures appoint their own slate of electors to the Electoral College and throw out the popular vote in their states because they claim some fraud occurred? And the Supreme Court, I think, has answered both of those questions and in a way that provides certainty to everyone.
You can find more information about our litigation team at HoganLovells.com. I hope you'll join us for the next episode of Proof in Trial. Until next time, I'm Kate Stetson.